with the House Bill 544. We'll be dealing with the Senate Joint Resolution 27, and it's the House Companion, House Joint Resolution 35. So with that, I would like to get started on House Bill 448, an act amending the definition of value for purposes of administration of fisheries tax. First, I would like to hear from the prime sponsor of House Bill 448, Representative Gail Phelps. Welcome to the House Resources Committee, Representative Phelps. And after you finish, you're certainly welcome to join us at the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we on teleconference?
Yes, all of our bills today will be on teleconference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, very much, and to members of the committee. I read the sponsor statement the last meeting we were here. Basically, House Bill 448 amends the value of fisheries tax to include ice handling, deliver, tender fees, and transportation, and it clarifies the meaning on value on fish taxes. I understand that we do have an amendment that is going to be presented at this meeting, and possibly at this time we could have the amendment.
Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment that is either in the process of being copied or has been copied, or somebody has it. It's around here, but we can either wait until it gets here, easier to talk to, or I can talk about the situation and present the amendment.
Okay, if you would just address your comments to the amendment, then I would like to hear from Mr. Chenoweth, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, my concern, I don't have a problem with this bill and closing the loopholes of those who are avoiding paying the tax, but I have concern about a disincentive to those fishermen who may choose to vertically integrate and transport and perhaps sell their own fish. And I'd like to be able to draw a line, and when they cross that line, then the fish is no longer part of the value for this price. And I think the amendment helps clarify that. For example, if a fisherman chooses to add value by either partial processing, which they can do now, and transporting to another market distant from the fishery, and add value to it, then I believe that, I don't believe it's the intent of the legislation, nor is it the Department of Revenue policy to collect tax on that. But I believe this amendment that you now have before you will help clarify that.
Thank you. Perhaps first, I wonder, Representative Phelps, why don't we hear from Mr. Chenoweth first, if you would please join us, and then I would like to hear your comments regarding the amendment, and we'll go from there. Good afternoon, Mr. Chenoweth, and welcome to the House Resources
Committee. Thank you.
Please identify yourself.
My name is Jack Chenoweth, and I am Legislative Council of Legislative Affairs and responsible for the bill. I hope all of you received an amendment. It's marked D1, and it's got some hints in there from the bottom of it, but
Chenoweth 03-1292.
I was asked to prepare something generally responding to Representative Lehman's concern about the inclusion in the value of, or the exclusion, I should say. He was looking for some way of excluding from the determination of value the element of transportation or delivery to a distant, to a place distant from the fishery. And so this amendment that you have is intended to try to be responsive to that. And it's not as bad as it looks. Value means, and then subparagraph A is the same language as lines 9, 10, and 11 of the original bill. I just flipped the order as a drafting matter. Value means the market value of the fishery resource if the taking of the fishery resource is done in company-owned or company-subsidized boats operated by employees of the fisheries business or in boats that are operated under lease or other arrangement. That is the law now. That provision was in Representative Gail Phelps' bill. It's just set out in a different order. 11B covers situations other than the taking being done in company-owned or company-subsidized boats. For fisheries resources other than those described in A of this paragraph, the actual price value means the actual price paid for the fisheries resource by the fisheries business to the fishermen, should be singular, fishermen, including indirect consideration and bonus amount paid for fuel, supplies, gear, ice handling, tender fees, or delivery, whether paid at the time of purchase of the fisheries resource or tendered as a deferred or delayed payment. Now, let me just stop there. At the suggestion of the Revenue Department, the words "to the fishermen" were added to indicate the actual point at which the tax, the transaction becomes determined, the taxable transaction can be determined. And I've dropped from this laundry list of examples the word "transportation," which was in Representative Phillips' bill. Representative Lehman was of the notion, I think he may be right, that transportation and delivery were essentially one and the same. Why add more terms than you need to? Delivery, of course, is the key to Representative Lehman's concern, so we try to address delivery to cut out the addition of value to points distant from the fishery by saying at the very end, delivery means transportation of the fishery product from the boat or vessel on which the product was taken to a tender, that's your offshore situation, or two, if delivery was not to a tender, then the transportation of the fishery product from the boat or vessel on which the product was taken to a shore-based facility in which delivery of the fishery product is normally accepted. So again, it would be the costs of delivery or the value added by delivery, but generally to the shortest point, the nearest point to where that fishery product was taken. I think that tends to be responsive on that issue.
So Tim Carney?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chenoweth, back to A on the amendment.
Yes.
You said that's existing law. My question is, does existing law provide for a tax on privately owned and operated boats? Does this definition include them, or is it only company boats or those that are leased?
We're taxing fishery. We're not taxing real personal property. We're taxing the fishery product, fish or shellfish or whatever it might be. This is not a tax on the value of the vessel.
I know that. But my question is, I'm probably missing something, so you'll have to clarify. But it appears to me that we do not tax the fish that are sold from privately owned boats. Unless I'm reading this.
You mean the fisherman who himself pulls in and...
No, I mean, suppose I own my own boat. Do I pay a tax on the fish I sell?
Yes.
How would the revenue come in? Today.
You're Paul Dick, right?
Yes.
Thanks, Jim. Representative Lehman, while you're getting settled there.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carney, if I could just maybe help clarify, but it's what it says here under value. It says in the first case, it is the market value. In the second case, it's the actual price paid, if it's not that first condition. And let me describe it. Let's say that somebody owns, a processor owns a vessel and maybe gear and leases that to a fisherman. And we'll say in Cook Inlet, a normal lease rate may be 27% of the, somewhere around that price. But if you didn't have this paragraph in here saying that, then the actual price paid would be 27% less than it should be. And so this actually raises, market value raises the price up to what everybody else is getting who owns their own vessel.
I see. So there's other language somewhere that addresses the tax for
right below
owner operator.
In Part B.
Right. Mr. Dick?
For the record, my name is Paul Dick. I represent the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, Representative Carney, the way I understood your question was meaning you're centering on the word company versus private, meaning that a company may be a corporate-owned boat. The Department of Revenue policy is to consider it broadly, and meaning company would mean whether it's privately owned or corporate-owned, it would be the value of the fish on the boat.
Thank you. Better.
Additional questions by members of the committee? Thank you, Mr. Dick. Thank you, Mr. Chenoweth. Representative Phillips, did you have comments regards to the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have no problem with the amendment.
So, pleasure of the committee regards to the amendment. I'm sorry. Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of amendment number one. And that's unanimous consent.
Is there objection? Without objection, then we have before us a committee substitute for House Bill number 448, Resources. What is the pleasure of the committee regards to committee substitute House Bill 448? Representative Carney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move and ask unanimous consent that committee substitute House Bill number 448 be reported out of committee with fiscal notes, individual recommendation, and ask unanimous consent.
Representative?
No.
Representative Carney, I'm sorry, would you please state again the bill that you, did you say committee substitute House Bill 448 resources?
I didn't say resources.
Oh, okay, maybe it's not necessary, but, okay. So, you asked unanimous consent, is there objection? Without objection, committee substitute House Bill 448. Committee substitute for House Bill number 448 moves from committee with individual recommendations. Next, we will go with House Joint Resolution 68, urging the Congress to reopen the Navy allotments process for the benefits of Navy military veterans. And the sponsor is the House Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs. And we have the chairman of that committee, Representative Ivan, as a member of the Resources Committee. Representative Ivan. Yes, sir. We are on teleconference for all of our bills today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for scheduling this bill in a timely manner. I'd like to first give a background to the intent of this legislation. It's requesting Congress to amend federal law that would allow otherwise eligible Alaska Native veterans a new 18-month filing period for Native land allotments. Some of our Native veterans served during the Vietnam conflict, and many were overseas and could not take advantage of the land allotment program. It was discontinued when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed in 1971. And this resolution addresses that problem by requesting Congress to reopen this issue. And this is at the result, this was the result of the committee trip to Western Alaska, and was requested by Native veteran groups for us to consider introducing this legislation. With that, try to answer any questions that you may have.
Are there questions by members of the committee regarding House Joint Resolution 68 from Military and Veterans Affairs? No questions. Next, then, I would like to hear from Leo Land. Afternoon, Mr. Land. And, is that correct? It's Leo Land?
Or yes, Land? Sir, Mr. Chairman. It's Leo Land.
Okay. Welcome to the House Resources Committee, Mr. Land. If you would, please state your name for the record and who you represent, and give us your testimony.
I'm Leo Land. I'm from Haines. When I signed up, I put self. But I've always been fighting for veterans, so it's nothing new. And I wish to thank Mr. Ivan and any of the others on that special committee, because I forgot all about what happened. It's so long ago, I'm getting old. So I came down, and on your list of names, on that letter that I wrote and handed out yesterday, the people that typed it up left one of my sons off, and he's much bigger than I am. And he's a paratrooper in Vietnam. So David J. Land was the other one. Now, these here, the list we came up with was from the veterans themselves. I know them all. And some of them, as some people probably don't know, if you get Congress to do it, all they can do then is fill out the forms and see if they do qualify individually. They have to run through that, and that's what it amounts to. Well, I don't think there's much use in me saying much more, except one thing. Maybe we can get a little bit more ground back from that federal government. That will help up here. And I wish to thank you. If there's no questions, right?
Mr. Land, I had a question. This list here, is that just the veterans around Haines, Alaska? Are there other veterans throughout Alaska who would be similarly affected?
That is from Haines only, once we moved. And most of them, then, a lot of them was decorated. We got decorated, all kinds of things, like all of that. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's just us from our area. And my good friend Bill Thomas is here, and I think he's going to testify to him. He was.
Thank you very much, Mr. Land. My question to the chairman of the Military and Veterans Affairs Committee, would there be other people throughout the state who would be affected by this opportunity?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there would be all over the state, and certainly there was the Native Veterans that were involved in the Vietnam conflict, certainly testified at the last hearing that people from Kotzebue, Nome, and Bethel, and not only that, but all over the state that participated in defense of their country.
And so there will be some way that these veterans will be notified as to the extension of this opportunity?
That would be federal responsibility to notify that once they adopt our request.
Are there other questions by members of the committee, Representative Hudson? And for the record, let me announce, please, that we have been joined by Representative Hudson and Representative Zawacki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to acquaint me with what's at stake here, if we might, Representative Ivan, what are we talking about here on a personal basis? What is a land, what is a native land allotment? What did it consist of? I wonder.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to explain it as best as I know how. This is a federal legislation that permitted the American Indians to participate in acquiring land for traditional hunting, etc., throughout the state. And the Alaska Natives were considered as such. Alaska Natives were considered as such and were given the opportunity to apply for traditional hunting, fishing, berry picking, summer camps, fishing camps, the site that they lived on for generations to generation. And some of those sites belonged to where the families used to go out and hunt. And they were given that opportunity to apply for these. And we do have numerous applications throughout the state.
Just a quick follow-up. Ivan, was it a limitation of 160 acres? I'm just trying to get an idea.
Well, they could select up to 160 acres, and that's the limitation. Couldn't go beyond that. These are for individual persons and our families.
Thank you.
Vice Chairman Lincoln?
Just to add a little bit more to that, the deadline for the process was December 18th, 1971, so that it had to be prior to that from the Native Land Claims Settlement Act. And you can apply for 160-acre parcel to 80-acre parcels for 40-acre parcels, but like Representative Ivan said, it could not go beyond the 160. And the individual has to actually walk that area with BLM to show that they have used that particular parcel of land for some of those very things that Representative Ivan points out.
So, might I ask another question?
Please go ahead, Representative Ivan.
The deadline date in 71. What we're trying to do, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are we trying to draw comparable recognition for those veterans of Vietnam and Desert Storm and et cetera to have the same kinds of benefits and privileges?
This program, as my colleague from District 24 stated, the program ended in 1971. Those veterans, otherwise, if they had stayed here, they would have taken an opportunity and applied for land, but they were otherwise out of the country at that particular application period.
Additional questions? We will hopefully move out this House Joint Resolution 68 when the next meeting of the House Resources Committee, which will be March the 17th. So at that time, we intend to move. Representative Newman.
A bit of a question. I just wonder, why has it taken 20 years to get to this point? Have there been other delays? You know, but surely these people must have known sometime in the last 20 years that there's been, maybe there's some other bureaucratic delay. But I just wonder why it's taken 20 years to get to this point.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to answer that question to the best of my ability. Some of the folks, even upon their return, were not aware of the program. And it's not a light matter to try and convince the Congress or the United States government. It's going to take recognition by as a body to recognize that the problem existed, and hopefully with our actions here with this legislation will provide additional support for a group of those veterans, many veterans that, and that hopefully Congress will consider them in reopening the process. The effort has been done before the last several years.
I would like to move on to public testimony, and we have three people in Kotzebue. I'd like to hear first from Willie Goodwin. Hello, Willie. Good afternoon. Are you there in Kotzebue?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak on the resolution. My name is Willie Goodwin. I live here in Kotzebue. I'm also land manager for the Village Corporation of Kotzebue, Terry Stark Corporation. We at KIC have always supported any kind of benefits that our shareholders can get. And this is another one here that we support. We believe that those people that were out defending our country should have a right also, like we did, those of us that were home during the application period, that they should have an opportunity also to have a selection of land that they can apply for. And our Village Corporation here in Kotzebue certainly supports that effort. I believe Congress has already probably addressed it, but there's never been any legislation submitted to it. But with the state of Alaska supporting it, I believe we can get somewhere. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Goodwin. Next, I'd like to hear from Mr. Luke Sampson. Are you there, sir?
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I am Luke Sampson from Kotzebue. Veteran of Vietnam, and after serving two tours in Southeast Asia, at the time when the land claim settlement was happening, I, with many other Alaska Natives, was stationed in Southeast Asia. I remember receiving a packet in the mail from my parents, and there was a little note from my mother. And in that little note was a little message for me to sign where the X's were marked. And like every other Native Alaskan, they did not understand and did not explain in the letter what was all involved in the packet. At the moment, not having the time to review and ask anyone questions, in the environment that I was in, I went ahead, I did my signature, and mailed the packet out. I sit here this afternoon, excuse me, Mr. Chairman. For a record in support of House Joint Resolution number 68. Many of the veterans that have served in the Vietnam conflict are no longer with us today. It would be an honor for those that have passed and to the present veterans to reopen the Native Alignment process for the benefit of the Native military veteran. If all of you will remember that there weren't very many blades, if there was any at all,
you, Mr. Sampson. Appreciate your comments. Mr. Fred Armstrong, are you there?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Fred Armstrong. Veteran of the Vietnam area. I did not serve in Vietnam, but I was in a service during that time. And I echo both of the speakers' concerns and supporting Officer Resolution Number 68. I was in the service at the time all this happened. There was news took place, and you know, the land things took place. And being too young and, you know, carefree in the service, I didn't have much ties with home, and then coming back, discharged, and, you know, wondering why everybody's got land allowance, and we didn't. You know, it just felt kind of bad that we're sort of left out on a lot of things, and I would urge the committee to pass this resolution and submit to Congress for their debate and approval. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify on this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Armstrong. Appreciate it. Appreciate all three of you individuals in Kotzebue. I believe I met you on the trip we had up there. Hello, it's good to hear you again. Next, I'd just like to remind the committee without are there any questions? No questions, so we will take up House Joint Resolution 68 on Tuesday, March the 17th, at which time it would be the intention of the chair to move it out of committee. Next, I would like to go House Bill 544, and the prime sponsor is here. We have this is an appropriation of $375,000 for seed potato research, and the prime sponsor is Representative Beto Kopanen. Good afternoon, Representative, and welcome to the House Resources Committee.
Well, thank you, Representative Davidson. For the record, my name is Neil Kopanen. I'm the I'm sponsor of this bill and represented from District 21, which includes the University of Alaska. At the University of Alaska, there has been considerable research done in the area of fungus and virus diseases affecting plants, and Dr. Jennifer Macbeth has developed, as you see in your packet, types of natural, you might say, natural fungicides, i.e. funguses that fight the bad funguses, and also breeding types of potatoes that will themselves be free of fungus and viruses. This means that we have an opportunity to participate in the world seed potato market, which is valued at $5 billion a year. This is not growing potatoes for French fries, but growing potatoes to feed a market, the market that produces the potatoes for French fries. So the value added is considerably more, and the price is considerably higher. This represents a very useful economic tool, and actually one of the more feasible economic developments in the area of agriculture that we can foresee. The reason for the resolution, the bill, and the proposed amendments is to make sure that there is cooperation between the Division of Agriculture and Department of Natural Resources and the University of Alaska in development of the program, and also to see that the money goes directly to the agricultural program instead of sinking into the general overall fund of the university itself and making up some leaks in other areas. And I understand that we have Dr. Macbeth and others on the teleconference to testify, so I will close my testimony at that.
The amendment then addresses the large bureaucratic hole, is that?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Representative. Question by Representative Hudson.
Yes. Representative Kopanen, does the pass-through of these funds through DNR generate any administrative spinoff of these funds? I'm interested in this project because I think it's good to develop a good sound seed potato there. That's a good thing to do. But I hope we're not passing it through admin. I remember in the past when we had passed money through DOT and they'd sometimes take as much as 35% overhead.
and the amount of money that went into research was diminished considerably. I would hope that's not the case here.
The appropriation is for the full fund to be passed through, and given the meeting that the Division of Agriculture has had in recent years, I don't think they will find very much more to do anyway other than pass the money through.
Representative Copeland, are these both of these are doctors, Dr. Hubert and Dr. McBeth?
Hmm?
They're both doctors, is that, did you say?
I'm not sure. Dr. McBeth is a doctor, I'm not sure the other person.
I'd like next to go to the teleconference, and Mr. Hubert in Palmer, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. I'm having a terrible time hearing you folks. You're cutting out an awful lot. I hope you receive my testimony better than what I can understand you. Can you hear me all right?
Yes. How about now? Can you hear us better?
Yeah, that is so much better. You cut it out. I would like to thank Representative Copeland for his presentation and go one step further in saying that the potatoes that will be produced in Alaska will be for state producers in the South 48. Now, they will pay a tremendous price for a virus-free, ring-rot-free, scab-free potato product to plant to produce seed for that market down there. And Alaska is fortunate in its isolation. And the other thing that is in our favor is there's a large area in Alaska to grow seed potatoes because the smaller size will bring the premium versus the larger size when you go to fresh markets. Now, I am a fresh market producer in the Matanuska Valley, and I have a lot of faith in Dr. McBeth. I have been acquainted with her and talked to her several times about this and other problems, and I believe that she is on the right track of using what you might say the natural enemies of the viruses and the bacteria that we have versus going to some chemical use. I think that this is the forefront of agriculture that Alaska has a tremendous opportunity in. And I've been involved in business up there, as Representative Carney knows, for several years. And I think that we have been lacking in research. Research is something that we very sorely need. So I would wholeheartedly support this effort of Dr. McBeth. So I thank you for the chance to answer any questions if I can hear you.
Thank you, Mr. Hubert. Next, I'd like to hear from Dr. McBeth. Are you there? In Fairbanks, I believe.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Please go ahead. If you would, please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Okay. I'm Jennifer McBeth, and I'm from the Division of Associate Professor of Plant Pathology and Biotechnology at the University of Alaska Survey. And I'm here to testify for House Bill 544. And I thank you for the opportunity, and I also I appreciate very much your time and interest while I was in Juneau 2 weeks ago. I would have come to see you for this occasion. If it's not, I just came out of the hospital yesterday after a major surgery. So I feel that what I would like to do today is I would like to support Mr. Huber's testimony, and I also thank Representative Copeland's support on this bill. I believe this will bring will open up a new revenue for the state, which we very urgently need at this time and in the future. Well, our oil revenue is lovely. So that's a sweet potato, grows very well in Alaska. It's one of the few crops we can grow without very much effort. And the seed market is getting more and more important because Rural 48 and the other countries that they are facing the problems that their farmland is getting overtaken by urbanization, so they are in dire need to look for a place that they can buy potatoes without and so we can have funds to start working toward a solution of this problem, and then the market is there. And the minute we can prove that we have no that your ring lab and the virus-free and we can sell it right away. So, well, I thank you very much for your support, and I will be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Dr. McBeth. We have a question from Representative Moyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Nilo said, he represents the university where the research is taking place. Most of the potato farming happens to occur in the district I represent. Jennifer, for my own education, perhaps you could briefly explain what's the difference between a bacteria and a virus.
Okay, they are all microorganisms, and the virus is the one that usually causes flu. Chicken pox in humans, and they are sort of between living and non-living creatures. However, bacteria is the one that usually create inflammation on the skin, produce pus and that sort of thing. And then they are considered living. And then they are all both very small, and they pass through different means. But in terms of tail, bacterial ringlet is caused by bacteria, and then it's visible in a way that when you buy potatoes from the supermarket, sometimes when you cut it open, you see a ring, sort of a grayish brown ring around near under the skin of the potato. And when you squeeze them, you can see the pus-like substances oozed out of the ring. And of course, that's not the end of it, because then it will continue to deteriorate, and then, of course, those potatoes are not edible. And then that wound itself, that will get onto the containers and the two bags and all that, and then will infect other potatoes, so then get into a chain reaction. Virus itself is transmitted by tick potatoes, the same way as our bacterial ringlet, because they are propagated by tissues, tubers, not by seed. However, bacteria, the virus, another very serious problem that has is transmitted by insects. So if one insect flies about 3 hours in a plant, fly to another field, and then they can start to feed on that plant, and then that plant will get sick, and then it will start to spread. That's a problem now the Lower 48 and the other countries are facing, because in the past, they have an isolated area designated for seed table growing, and some areas are for table stock for fresh market. And then because urbanization, so then many of those farmlands are taken away, so then the distance between the table stock and then the seed table growing area is getting shorter and shorter. As a consequence, and then the virus carrying leafhoppers and aphids, they could fly from one field to another. So which means that, and then of course, then there's a different standard applied, a different standard of stringent that applies between, you know, to the six-year or to the tumor cells. The tumor cells, they don't care that much because they want to sell the potatoes. They don't care whether the potato plant has disease or not. And then, even though they might lose yield, but usually the first yield, the first year yield of table stock of carrier virus are not pronounced. However, if a seed potato has the virus, and then the table stock comes out of that seed potato, will cause a tremendous yield loss. So then that means the seed potato farmers have to apply very frequently with the very toxic chemicals, in this case, insecticides. That's much worse than fungicides. And so now they are facing, and but besides, it will be very costly. So the farmers are facing, you know, uphill battles because they try to sell seed potatoes, and then they have to spray so frequently that causes their neighbors to protest against the detrimental effect on the environment, and also that they're harmful for their own health. So that's why many of, they're to the point that they say it just doesn't pay for them to potato lots are smaller, are not just larger as the potato sound. So they could create a sort of a vacuum and then for them to grow 50 units. We have the same advantage. And we have the geographic isolation. We're surrounded by mountains and oceans. And we have the cold weather and then the west, as well as we do not bring virus contaminated potatoes to growing Alaska. We don't ever have to worry about virus problems, and we can continue to produce virus-free potatoes. And on top of that, if we could produce a scab-free potatoes, that will be an additional bonus that we can't charge for. So that's why I see this is a great opportunity, and that we're not only one right now aiming at, you know, looking at the market. The Asian countries are looking at the market. They don't have the land, but they do have the people. So they are trying to develop the potato industry in the laboratory, which will be exorbitantly costly, but then they want to compensate it with their cheap labor. And I urge you to support this bill, because I do see this is a tremendous opportunity. This is the window that you will miss it, and then other people will fill in, and then they take their initiative, and then they take away the opportunity Alaska would have. And even if we try to recapture it, it will be so much harder, just like our automobile industry, that we lost our initiative many years ago, and now we have to try very hard to catch it back. And that's what I feel. I don't know if I answer your question to your satisfaction, but I will be answering to further clarify it.
Say this. There's a follow-up question, Dr. McBeth. We have another question from Representative Moyer, and then one from Representative Hudson. Representative Moyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jennifer, you may not be able to answer this, but many of the potato farmers also grow other crops, as well as other farmers in the area that do grow other crops. And they, too, face, I presume, diseases. What other diseases may be preventing some of our crops from enjoying the same potential, this economic potential as seed potatoes, or perhaps there aren't any other crops that have this kind of potential?
Actually, I think we have tremendous potato is just the beginning, because, for instance, vegetables. Amongst us, we all are well famed for giant cabbage and then our broccoli. And our corn plants. We could start exploring the possibility of growing, for instance, bacteria-free broccoli. And I don't know if you have a solution to the broccoli you have buying in the supermarket or anything. Sometimes when you buy the broccoli, then it's of course it comes through the packaging and the cool storage and that sort of thing. And then, you know, sometimes what if they look, they will notice that they have a little water soaked sort of a sign on their the broccoli head and the flower parts that you're eating. If you smell it, they get a little sulfuric smell. And they're soft. You touch them and you make a great indentation. They don't taste too good. And that's caused by a bacteria, soft rot. And so right now in the world, there's no other place to grow soft rot free broccoli seeds, because the bacteria is carried to this case through the state. And but in Alaska, we have some isolated area. I was thinking that it's one of the Kansas states, that's a delta, and Arlington and Kenai, many areas, and even many of the villages in the various side of Alaska. They are isolated, and you don't have to grow very large acreage, because seeds, you know, very tiny, and then they are high concentrated of bacteria-free seeds in vegetable, and they could cost as much as $1 a pound.
I'm going to ask a question.
Vegetables are tiny, but still, that's a lot of money. And so I feel that right now what we need is one success stories, and we can start it with potatoes. maturing carbon and the Stella seed, which is at premium price, then sell $2 a pound here and there for the people, you know, for the community market.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Dr. McBeth. Next is Representative Hudson and Representative Lehman. After Representative Lehman, we will go to Kenny Lake. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mine is not a question of Dr. McBeth, but simply a statement that that this appears to me to be a prime project for science and technology, and particularly given the extremely short revenues that we're going to have for all other normal purposes. And I know that that's the kind of an issue that will be handled in finance, but I would hope at any rate that we might even pass that suggestion on, because the title clearly seems to imply this is coming out of general funds.
Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. McBeth, my question, or maybe comment, is along the same lines, had to do with the money amount. The project appears to me to be a worthy one, but when I look in the back page and how the budget was derived, I see 5 research assistants, each, while maybe not handsomely paid as compared to the pay of other university professors, certainly the pay is more than what a graduate student would get. I wondered if you'd fully explored the use of lower cost graduate students and maybe fewer research assistants, maybe some that are more diverse than just the specialists in plant genetics, maybe some that are have some cross-cultural training, if you will. And I just want to explore any ways that we can look at reducing that cost.
Is my turn to answer, President Chairman?
Yes, if you would like to answer, that would be fine.
Okay, I have some comments and also would like to answer Representative Lehman's question. I have tried for 2 years to, with the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation, continuously trying to get money to do some research on the bacterial ringrot, and I have not been very successful. The reason, 2 years ago, that was, they said, it's not a problem for Alaska, and it will not be a problem for Alaska, even though at that time I predicted it would become a major problem, and they did not believe it. And then 3 years later, and farmers are, they demand that this problem stop, and then I send my proposal to them again, and then they came back denied again, and they said still not a problem. So I have tried with the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation. I know they have their own duties in terms of, and their own responsibility for their own charter. And but the problem is, I certainly could continue to explore that knowledge, but I believe the times are fighting right now, and now we cannot. We lost their time 3 years already. And then this is another window we have, and if we don't do something quickly, we'll make that too. I think maybe eventually something could work out between the state and the Alaska Science Technology Foundation and work out which side of this fund to come from which unit, and that's fine with me. But my feeling is, as a scientist, that I have seen this problem coming, and I was proved right, which I did not want to be. And then I can predict to you now, if we miss this chance, we will not see Alaska getting to the seed market very easily. And then if we want to do it later, will be much more expensive. To answer Representative Lehman's questions, I have tried to explore other routes to the time limit, then it's no problem. I could get a graduate student to work on it. 5 years later, I produce a piece of result. But we're trying to sell potato, seed potato to the seed market. And then we need to, every year, the farmers produce seed. Every year, farmers produce crops, and they want to sell somewhere. And the farmers, they borrow money from the state. Many farmers carry $1 million loans. The state invested those money on them with the purposes to get the return. What good will that do to the state? Our farmers, they produce crops nobody wants. And then we're not selling anything. We're not developing agriculture. And in that case, we're fooling ourselves. I look at this budget. I know it's big. But the thing is, it's necessary budget because I could ask for assistant professors. In that case, each of those experts or specialists will cost at least $80,000 a year with benefits. And I do not. I am for research associates. And all the research associates currently work in my lab, they have PhDs. They are every bit as good or as any other professors that we hire at the university. But they have one function, something, that is to do research. They don't have to get involved in the company. They don't have to get involved in services apart from describing their duties. And I feel this is the best way to utilize the funds. That's why I presented this way. And I think, I remember one time, one of the representatives I talked to while I was in Juneau 2 weeks ago asked me, hey, Jennifer, can you use burlesque? I thought about it, and I said, no. I said, for one, I don't play games. If I play games, I could ask you for $500,000, and I negotiate with you. I say, all right, oh, well, I will be good, and I will ask for $300,000. I'm not. I tell you what I want, and it's not what I want, but rather what takes to do the job. Because by taking this job, this money, I put my own reputation on the line. I have to compete. I have to help the market, help the farmers to produce virus-free, bacteria-free potatoes for the seed market. And if I don't, and the reputation I spent the past 20 years to build will go down the drain with this money. It's really, in a way, it's not worth my while to take it. It's big responsibility. And another thing is, I also say it will not be fair for the state or for the farmers if I take less and then deliver less. Because for one, it's not fair to the farmers because farmers expect certain things. And then if I tell them, sorry, I cannot deliver because I get less, and then they don't get what they want, they still cannot sell the potatoes. And it would not be fair to the state, because state, that's the funds, they expect certain returns. But when you do not give enough to produce the result, and you get nothing in return. And so, and another thing, I jokingly say, by doing that, the state really and willingly gives me a very easy way out. Because if you give me less, and I say, all right, I take it, and then I don't produce the result, and later, maybe I could be even unscrupulous enough to spend this money in Hawaii Beach. Come back and you say, how come there's no results? And I say, well, you never give me enough, so what do you expect? So now I am
Dr. Macbeth? Dr. Macbeth? Hello, Dr. Macbeth? Can you hear me?
Yes.
We're going to have to move on here. We do have another question from Representative Sawacki. So is there anything else left on that question? Because we must move on.
No, I'm sorry.
You think, Representative Sawacki?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll hold the, it's more of comments, and I'll hold those comments when we address the bill in itself at this time. I don't have any questions.
Thank you. Then I'll go on to the teleconference network, and in Kenny Lake, I understand we have three people to testify. Hello, Kenny Lake, we do not have your name, so if you would please come up and give us your names, and then in order, give us your testimony on House Bill 544.
Yes, this is Eric Nashley and Kenny Lake. I'm a small-scale producer of vegetables and all. And I'd like to go on the record as...
Excuse me, sir. Sir? Sir?
...to paying a high price for seed and seed potatoes. I don't mind this. I'm paying for results. My job is what's going to feed myself and my family. So when I see that there's a possibility here for another market, especially one in seed potatoes, I take a look and I say, well, this is something I could get into. This is something that I could sell in 148 because there is a market there. But as a private individual and a small producer, I myself cannot afford to spend the money for this research. That's why I look to the state to fund this. I saw this as a historic example. And we would not be talking on this teleconference right now if Bell Laboratories had not given some money for research. And by doing so, the researchers, doing some good research, stumbled upon the transistor. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Is there someone else there in Kenny Lake? And the gentleman who just spoke, would you give us your name again, please?
Yes, this is Eric Nashland.
Eric Nashland?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Al Roy, and I'm a farmer here in Kenny Lake, and I support House Bill number 544. I think it's a good idea, and it's the same research that had been applied years ago to alfalfa up here, which we were doing very well with there. We'd be a lot further along. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Morgan. Is there another person in Kenny Lake who wishes to testify?
Well, this is Ruth, your teleconferencer. No, there were just the two. And the spelling on that first gentleman's name is N-A-S-H-L-U-N-D. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth, and thank you, everybody in Kenny Lake. We'll next move on to Fairbanks. And Rudy Better, are you there, Mr. Better?
Yes, I am. First, I would like to testify to the right to House Joint Resolution number 68.
Mr. Better, we're not on that resolution yet.
Simply with any veteran.
Sir? Sir? Oh. Sir?
He's
already done.
I believe that's a good bill. I think that we got to stay up with research. We're state of the art. We better get with it or we're going to get lost in the rich. I produced potatoes in Washington State in the late 30s. As I have the other two bills in regard to mine, I'd like to state that I am for those to expedite things. Thank you.
Thank you. Sylvia Ward. Ms. Ward, are you there, please? And please testify on House Bill 544 at this time.
No comments on 544. I would like to comment on the later Bill 35.
Okay, we'll be back to you in a few minutes. Thank you. With that, I would announce then that we will return to House Bill 544 on March the 17th, at which time we will, what would be the pleasure of the committee? Can we adopt the amendment as proposed by the sponsor of the bill? You have two sheets of the amendment. They say exactly the same thing. The staff just felt that the one that you were handed second would be easier to see how it fits in. Vice Chairman Lincoln.
Mr. Chair, I move for the amendment number one, and without objection.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hudson,
objection. Just for discussion, I'll remove my objection.
My interest in funding this bill is from science and technology or some other source, and I worry a little bit about putting the Department of Natural Resources as the grant recipient in this instance, because I'm not confident that the Department of the Science and Technology Foundation can make that appropriation to them rather than making it straight to the person that's going to do the work. So I'll remove my objection and let this go forward, but I want that for the record.
Okay, perhaps if we could, at the next meeting, we could address the Department of Natural Resources as well as the question on the science and technology, or if possible, if they in fact intend to go forward with requesting those funds. And next Tuesday, if we could have that information. Representative Dwacky.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess something else that I guess concerns me is why we're even talking about an appropriation, because if you look at this, it looks like it's a one-time grant, which it's not. If you look at the budget, it says a yearly budget. These are operating costs for employees. If this is going to be part of the Department of Natural Resources, it should be in their operating budget, because we're not going to be coming back for a grant each year, because it says right here where your salaries are, and this is a yearly budget. I don't know why we're sitting here and talking about an appropriation, quote, for this year, when this is in perpetuity.
Where do you get that language or that idea?
In my packet right here on the very, and this, I believe, came, the Diagnostic and Consultative Diseases of Alaska. It doesn't say who it came from, but if you go to the third page, at the very top, it says budget, yearly, personnel salaries and benefits. This $370,000 is not a grant. It is for personal salary and benefits. It is a yearly budget. It belongs in the operating budget as a request from the Department of Natural Resources, not as a grant or appropriation, as this bill emphasizes out there.
I would ask the sponsor to address that concern at the next meeting. Could you do that now? Thank you. Please state your name for the record.
Okay, I just pushed this on. English.
You don't have to push.
Okay. I'm Pat Clark, and I work for New York Open, representing New York Open. And Jennifer McBeth did address this, and this is, she is not quite sure how many years it would take. And she's looking in perspective 5, maybe 10, and it's something that's research dependent upon research.
So it does, in fact, become part of an operating budget request through DNR to the university for that specific program for purposes of expanding economic opportunities in Alaska. Is that correct?
I can save this now.
Okay. Thank you very much. And Representative Moyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the Representative Dwacky's comments. It's not at all uncommon for us to get appropriations bills through the committees, whether it's for a one-year basis or ongoing. Now, we talked about here the resource policy, and I assume that when it gets to finance, we choose to pass along, which I hope we do, they'll discuss the budgetary options. It's not at all unusual to have these kind of forums.
Thank you.
It's not uncommon to see a specific project in a bill and suggest appropriation to that. However, I'm a little concerned that that wasn't made clearer to all of us as we looked at this thing, because I also had the impression that this was a one-time grant to the Department of Natural Resources for this specific project, and we'd see some results from that. If we're talking about 5 or 6 or 7 years potential or something like that, obviously, you want to make certain that you're going to see it through the long haul if you're going to entertain it at all. So I think as this goes forward, that needs, if we look at this again, we need to ask the prime sponsor a little more information.
So we have before us, thank you very much, Pat, appreciate your comments and comments. We have before us the sponsor, the amendment to the sponsor substitute for House Bill 544. What is the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hudson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we carry forward the amendment to the next hearing of this bill without taking action, sir. that is, keep it alive and attach it to it and take action at the next time we hear this bill. I'd like to have some of the answers before we deal with this, sir.
Feeling of the committee, Representative Moyer?
Actually, I don't have a problem with that, Mo. I would concur that there's enough questions to hold off on this.
Representative Finkelstein, did you have a comment?
No, I just correct.
Scratching your head. Okay, what we will do then, we will take up House Bill 445, first, I don't know if it's going to be the first order of business, but we will address House Bill 544 again on the 17th of March. With that, I'd like to go on to Senate Joint Resolution 27 and its companion bill, a resolution, House Joint Resolution 35, and request that the prime sponsor of the Senate resolution, Senator Frank and Representative Miller, if you'd like to join us at the table too. Thank you for coming this afternoon to the Resources Committee, and go ahead.
Assume we are on teleconference?
Yes, we are, sir.
Yeah, Jennifer, like to first.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess we didn't know how you were going to do this, whether you had them both my resolution and Representative Miller's resolution on the schedule, and I'm certainly glad that you scheduled the resolution. And I guess I'll just open up with some remarks, and then Representative Miller could follow, I guess, if that's your pleasure, or would you choose to go with the House bill first, or what?
Well, go ahead. Your bill is here from the other body, and so we'll take your resolution first, and if there is agreement or disagreement, we'll follow your comments up with comments by Representative Miller.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, thanks for scheduling the hearing on this subject. We were made aware of potential changes in the mining law of 1872 that Congress is contemplating. Bills have been introduced in both the House and the Senate. The Interior Committee met last year in Fairbanks. At that time, I did testify in favor of not changing the broad policy and concept of the mining law of 1872. It was a very well attended hearing for your information in Fairbanks. One of the halls at the university was packed, I would say, with people that are interested in the bill. The mining law of 1872 has been working well. It has been amended apparently more than 50 times. Other federal law covers reclamation standards and that sort of thing. So it is still working. It's working to promote mining, to promote the mineral industry. I think the mineral industry is very important to Alaska. We're seeing a tremendous resurgence of hard rock mining, creating good, well-paying jobs, stable jobs, long-term jobs that I think are key, or one of the key elements to an economic future for Alaska. And I think to see the federal mining law changed in a way that would discourage mining or reduce the incentive for exploration and mine development, I think would be detrimental to our state. I think it's important that Alaska take a position on the issue and to send a message to Congress that we do support the existing law and that we do not believe that wholesale changes in the way that mineral entry occurs is changed in this state, of course, and in all the federal lands. So I guess I would complete my testimony. I would be available to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Does the committee have questions of Senator Frank? No, Representative Finkelstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I took most of my notes on this on the House version. Are they basically the same?
Yes, it's my understanding that the versions are the same in both versions of the bill.
I have a bunch of concerns with the whereases in this. I think a number of them are factually incorrect or give a message that we don't want to give. Mr. Chairman, is it appropriate time for me to start going through it? I don't know who's going to respond except the sponsor.
Well, before we get into that, maybe we should allow Representative Miller
sure.
to give her comments, and then we'll come back to your concerns. Representative Miller, please.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am very pleased that you scheduled this resolution that I have presented, House Joint Resolution 35. And as you well noted, Senator Frank's version of the resolution, Senate Joint Resolution 27, has passed the Senate and is now with your committee. As best I can tell by comparing word for word, these are the identical resolutions. I would be pleased to answer questions, but if I might, Mr. Chairman, I would call your attention to the packet, and evidently you have looked at these materials that I supplied. But in my comment letter, I would like to call your attention to the second page, and if I could read from that, because there are some of the concerns I've heard in particular, and in the second paragraph, about two-thirds of the way down, I'd like to, by way of reading, to in that manner put on record address some of the concerns I have heard about the 1872 mining law and about my support for the existing federal mining law system. The mining law is a land tenure law and was never intended to be an environmental law. I'll add that Senator Frank has indicated that it has been amended numerous times since its first passage. Thus, while opponents of the mining law clearly mean to suggest that defects in that law have allowed the mining industry to escape environmental responsibility, their implication is simply false. Like any other industry, the mining industry remains subject to federal and environmental protection laws of general applicability, such as the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. In fact, a significant body of federal laws directly or indirectly amends or modifies both the mining law and the operations conducted under it. Continuing on in the third paragraph on the second page of my commentary, this brings us to the widespread charge that miners have a unique and unfair ability to purchase federal land at the ridiculously low price of $2.50 to $5 an acre. In point of fact, this is not a purchase fee, but rather the administrative fee to apply for a mineral patent. Once paid, there is no guarantee that such a patent will be granted, but this entire subject merely serves to cloud the true costs associated with gaining a mineral patent. Long before a patent may be applied for, the applicant must already meet both the prudent man test and also the extremely rigorous marketability test. It's not my intention to pretend that the federal mining law system is not sometimes abused for the purpose of land speculation. Such abuses are quite rare, however, and it is precisely the rarity of these abuses that makes them noteworthy when they are brought to our attention. I would conclude by reiterating that it is our responsibility as legislators to defend the interests of our Alaskan people, particularly because we are a resource-driven state. Ironically, however, many of Alaska's most important battles are fought a continent away by people who very often lack a basic understanding of the unique gifts and burdens of our way of life. That way of life is being threatened by those who seek to undermine the foundations of the federal mining law system. I therefore urge the members of this committee to consider carefully the materials before you and the resolution. And Mr. Chairman, whatever the wish of the committee is in regard to both of these resolutions before you, I am fully aware that the instrument in Senator Frank's SJR 27 is most likely the instrument for legislation in in the 17th legislature.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative Finkelstein, your concerns, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to talk about the resolution on the whereas, but some of the points that Representative Miller made sort of concern me as well. One of the ideas behind the 1872 mining law, I do believe, is a frontier relic. And it's this idea that you go out and you get the minerals for free. And your argument is, well, this isn't the true cost. You got to go out there and you got to meet the prudent man test. You got to make sure there's minerals out there. But let's apply that same argument to something else. Someone wants to go build a lodge on the federal land. That would mean they get to go out there, they pay their $5 for the, you know, the land, which is just a filing fee. And then they aren't going to have to pay any annual leases, aren't going to have to pay anything as a percentage of the money they get in. All they got to do is meet a prudent man test, which means is it a realistic chance that they're going to be able to pull some tourists in here and make some money? And are we on teleconference?
Yes, you are.
And the marketability test, you know, is their tourism resource here and their lodge marketable? Is there a chance that they really are going to get people in here, or are they just building this lodge to have a hideaway? Assuming that they really are trying to, you know, to get people in there and there's a chance to succeed, they get it for free. But there's no other resource out there, not timber, not recreation, not tourism. There's nothing I can think of, and not oil and gas, not uranium, and not materials. There's nothing left of the public domain resources that are given away free to hard rock minerals. And you know, I don't know how you can say that the true costs are being paid. They aren't being paid. There's nothing being paid. I guess that's my first question. You know, how can you say that there's true costs being paid when they pay nothing?
Senator Frank?
Well, one response I would have to that is that we do have federal income tax that would generate an awful lot of money. We have a federal corporate income tax that if it was a corporate form or a personal, you know, I guess the way I see this mining law working is that it is an opportunity for Alaskans to create jobs in Alaska on federal lands, and it's an opportunity for our nation's economy to create jobs. And if you want to look at it from the revenue to the treasury standpoint, I think there are dollars going into the treasury, and you know, they're pretty substantial when you consider that our federal income tax rates on a corporation's profits are, I think they're somewhere between 30 and 50. I'm not sure exactly what they are. And, you know, of course, the personal rates vary on your income level, but those are substantial net profit taxes that occur. And, in fact, I think, you know, we've all listened to a great deal of testimony with regard to what the best kinds of taxes are. And we've heard many economists come before us and tell us that a regressive tax is not a good idea, that a tax on severance may in fact stop production and stop employment well before it should on the basis of the economics of the entire operation. So I think that you know, that it is to limit the discussion as to the federal treasury's benefit to just a rents or royalties consideration is too limited. I think we should look at it in terms of the total. And you're creating jobs, there's a potential for jobs and a potential for significant money to the treasury through the creation of our resource, or, you know, creation of jobs to develop resources.
Mr. Chairman, I agree that's true. But tourism pays income tax, logging pays income tax, everyone pays income tax. The question is, why should hard rock mining and only hard rock mining, not coal, not uranium, not oil and gas, nothing else, why should they be the only ones that don't have to pay any royalties, anything? You know, why are they different? That's what's, you know, hard to understand. I didn't raise this point. I'm just responding to Representative Miller's testimony about the true cost here.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily, I don't know how to answer that question, really. But I do know that if mining does occur, and it occurs profitably, it will pay substantial taxes to the federal treasury. And in fact, it may pay a lot more, depending on the operation, than a tourism operation or a logging operation or whatever. And I think we need to look at it personally, primarily from how it affects our state and the people of our state, and not get lost on the federal government's policy.
How would, if we looked at the production of oil and gas in the way that you would like for us to look at hard rock mining, what would be the result, you think, as far as treasury and jobs and other benefits to Alaska?
I think that the economics of hard rock mining and the economics of oil and gas may be substantially different, and I don't know that you could compare them. There may be circumstances in which our severance tax, we got into the whole debate, many times, that if you have a severance tax that is not sensitive to income and profitability, you may have no production. And so I don't know that you can compare that.
Well, I agree, because I know we have the same problem when we talk about the common property resources of fisheries. It's price sensitive, and it's very easy to knock yourself out of the marketplace. So
it is.
I can appreciate, but,
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hudson.
Since we're seemingly discussing the merits or demerits of whether or not the Mining Act really serves a good public function or not, I think that each of these major industries has to be treated on their own merits, and the laws of our state and the land have to be addressed accordingly. There's this, I think, a misconception to some extent, and that is that governments have to achieve some money into government for those extractions and manipulations of our resources that produce jobs. And yet, we're all going to come and go and be buried away, and governments are going to continue to exist. I think the most important thing in a civilized society is that we have a strong, healthy economic base, and that means that we have the right kind of laws dealing with oil extractions. Royalties, for example, are different than mineral extractions. Severance taxes and production taxes and things of this nature there. So I hope that we don't try to draw a direct link or reference in the laws surrounding our mineral explorations and development with tourism, for example, because tourists simply come in, look things over, and leave. And we're talking, I grew up in a mining country, and it was that mining era, really, that raised me and my whole family. And I don't know that government ever got their fair share of that extraction, but certainly all the people that grew up in that neighborhood are here today because we were sustained by that. And I think that's part of manipulating the resources. So I don't think there's a direct comparison.
Vice Chairman Lincoln.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to go to the one whereas that I'm just kind of struggling with, and it is whereas mining must already comply with numerous state and federal laws concerning water, air quality, reclamation, land management, health and safety, and therefore we support the existing federal mining law system. That to the representative and senator, that we do have right now within my district, and I can say numerous, mining sites that have been left abandoned, that have as early as I'm thinking of even in my area, which is a mining area for gold, that even in my area that as early as, I believe it was 4 years ago, a mining company came in, a large mining company from Canada came in and just strip mined an area right outside of our village. We certainly did not have the reclamation that the state was supposed to be in charge of. There still is major, it just absolutely abandoned buildings, left the land in disarray. The water is a concern to, and I know that Senator Frank is aware of Birch Creek, that the water problems with mining in the Birch Creek area, the Rampart area, is another one that I'm thinking of that's just in our immediate district. And I have concern that that particular whereas that would imply that the state is already in compliance, I would certainly challenge the makers of this resolution that the state is way out of compliance.